Org Committee meeting to order.
You did it.
And as the rest of our colleagues will find their way in here in the next few moments, I just wanted to, I guess, remind people that these microphones are pretty directional, so if you speak into them, you need to speak to them as opposed to the chamber microphones, which are a little bit more, have a wider range, so that folks can hear us. We have today really I'll say the second of three reports back following the Fair Housing Resolution that came out of the Fair Housing Work Group. Last week we heard from the Fair Housing Coordinator from the Office of Financial Empowerment in the Mayor's Office, which was a piece of our resolution. Today we're hearing back from Council Research about some other pieces of the resolution, and next week we'll be hearing from PED about housing production and the Housing Trust Fund. And combining these three presentations, as well as work that's been happening within the Council, within the Mayor's Office, and with advocates, we will be moving forward with what we believe is I think last week we were talking about not wanting to let perfect get in the way of good and wait till we have a perfect one resolution to move forward with all of our tenant protections and all of our housing efforts, but just to start rolling things out on a rolling basis based on our priorities and what things are low-hanging fruit and that we can move forward quickly. So we are excited to get some information back today from our council research. I will turn things over to them. We have a big packet of information in front of us that it looks like we will be referring to, and so I look forward to your findings. Thank you for being here today.
Good morning, Council President Brenmo and council members. I'm Marcia Mormond in City Council Research with Nia Vang. We are both senior policy analysts and hearing officers for you. We're going to be talking today, as you said, about the direction that we received from the Council Org Committee. We're referring back to the ordinance that the Council passed last year establishing priorities for housing in 2019, and we highlighted those portions of that resolution that we'll be covering today. So those are tenant protection ordinances, including advance notice of sale, right to counsel for all tenants in housing court, just cause eviction and condemnation assessments, ordinances to reduce barriers to finding rental housing, including ban the box, limiting application fees, an emergency repair fund to make needed life safety repairs in rental properties in order to prevent displacement, and those would be to be assessed to the landlord, and working with community partners to increase the use of TRAs.
And before you get going any further, I would like to share that it looks like there's a packet or there's extra packets on the front desk if people are here to listen to the presentation and want to follow along with a paper packet. There's a bunch of them
absolutely
up here on the desk.
We brought these for people in the audience who would want them. So,
in addition to that, they're right up here on the corner of the desk. And then in addition to that, we'll be following along on the monitors to the sides. Sometimes I like to let people know that there is a monitor in front of the presenters. So if we look like we're blankly staring down, it is not because we have lost interest. It's because we're looking at the screen in front of us, but you can't see the screen, so we thought I'd let you know that. All right. There are no longer packets.
it is not our intention to read through this presentation in its entirety, but we will be pausing on a few points that are in front of you just for emphasis. For people who don't know Nia and I, as hearing officers and researchers, we've looked in the past at mortgage foreclosures, problem properties, poverty in St. Paul, and any number of other topics that help to inform our work here. But perhaps equally important is our work as hearing officers dealing on a daily basis with property owners, landlords, and tenants. We know that landlords have a responsibility, for example, for property maintenance, and there are assessments out there for doing cleanups that end up getting put onto tenants' security deposits when they had no real information that something needed to be taken care of on the property. For example, somebody called in that it needed snow shoveling or lawn mowing or whatever. So we see tenants literally come in with $350, $400 assessments that their landlord wants them to pay, and that is a regular occurrence, and that's a really big chunk of change. We also wanted to point out that we see over the years with all too much regularity landlords who rented out space for use as bedrooms which aren't safe. And that would be, we've seen condemned properties rented out, we've seen registered vacant buildings rented, rooms in basements, whether it has any separation from the utility space or not, or has egress windows. And we've seen landlords neglect repairs, not show for inspections. We've seen landlords try to play it so that the city has to condemn a property because they haven't done those needed fixes, and then the landlord is allowed to not have to go through the eviction process because an unsafe property was created. To be fair, and we did want to point this out, we've also seen cases where landlords come in and we've seen thousands and tens of thousands of dollars in damage that have been caused by tenants in various circumstances. So this is, it is not that we just see the one kind of circumstance. We do see both kinds of circumstances coming at us. But today's goal is talking about tenants and improving access and stability for tenants in the rental market. One theme that's emerged that's just really strong as we look at this topic is that we need to balance each of these proposals that are coming forward with the market impact that they may have. So you want to have the tenant protections go into place. And at the same time, you don't want it to squeeze so much that we have a reduction in rental units. And so how to find that balance where we are enhancing protections but not decreasing the number of units available. And without question, and everybody knows, the biggest tenant protection of all is a housing vacancy rate for tenants that is over 5%. And we're hovering between 2 and 4%. Which means that we have really constricted availability, but also it's a landlord's market. It is not a tenant's market, and so that's where the rules are made by definition. We do want to point out that 20% approximately of St. Paul's population lives in poverty. That means that St. Paul's population of tenants is much more likely to experience problems based on that criteria alone. The balance of Ramsey County is looking at about 8% of poverty. So we definitely hold the lion's share of concerns there. I bring this up because many of the solutions that we're talking about would be countywide, whether we're talking about social services or we're talking about the court system. We need to know that St. Paul is approximately three-fourths of what's going on in the tenant world that we've seen.
In Ramsey County.
In Ramsey County, exactly. Who we're talking about, we want to be super clear, and these are graphics that we just pulled forward from our poverty report that you received. And who's living in poverty? And it's quite clear that Black and African American people in St. Paul are more likely to experience poverty than other racial and ethnic demographics. Secondly, who's living in poverty? Families where we have a single mother with children. You know, that is who we have that we've been thinking about in the forefront of our minds as we've approached this thing. That is definitely where the greatest need is to reduce costs, improve simplicity, improve access. According to the American Community Survey, we know that St. Paul is like 50% rental. As opposed to the balance of Ramsey County, we're looking again at 30% rental, reinforcing that we're the rental market predominantly in the county. The rental cost burden, skipping forward, you heard about this last week from the Office of Financial Empowerment, and they provided some nice information. We have here the graphic on racial disparity and percent of households that are cost burdened, and you can see that there's a significant cost burden, but it's experienced more greatly by people of color, significantly more so, almost twice as likely to experience burdensome housing costs. What that means is moderately burdened means you're paying more than 30%, and severely burdened means you're paying more than 50% of your income. And this is something that is obviously problematic. And I need to note for you something that you all know, but in St. Paul, we're talking about the Public Housing Agency being the largest landlord by far. There are 4,273 public housing units and another 4,700-some housing choice vouchers out there. That means that we're talking about 8,987 units that the Public Housing Agency is in control of, and that, more importantly for our purposes today, the federal laws and regulations preempt the city from regulating those units. So we can write those ordinances and we can impose the policies, but they cannot be put in place over those particular units. Again, that's 16% of all the rental units in the city.
Is
16% of the rental units in the city are PHA units or vouchers. I'm moving along to tenant screening agencies and regulations and out of the introduction. And in the packet of materials you have a sample application for rental housing. And this is just a standard form that's out there. And I'll be referring to it a couple of times. When someone goes to apply for rental housing, they will get, hopefully, a form to fill out and that is decent and asks good questions. What is happening with these forms now? It used to be that landlords would make phone calls, you know, like 15, 20 years ago, it would be landlords making phone calls by and large, and some of them used tenant screening agencies and did a more comprehensive look. Right now, HomeLine is estimating that fully 80% of applications are reviewed through tenant screening agencies. So the role of a tenant screening agency has just ballooned, really, over the past number of years, which means that we need to be more sure than ever that good information is going in and coming out. The landlord under state law and local code needs to disclose that they're using a screening agency, who it is, and what criteria that they're going to be applying in reviewing the application. Pretty straightforward. The screening criteria generally fall into, they're looking at finances and credit, employment, rent payment, evictions, rental references. All of these things are intended to provide background information on whether the tenant will be financially capable of making rent payments on a monthly basis. Now, whether or not these are the right criteria and how they should be measured by the landlord is a further discussion, but that is kind of how it is examined right now. In terms of criminal background checks, we've listed out a few different places that they are examined. We'll return to that in a few minutes. We'll have a more in-depth conversation on criminal background checks. And lastly, having to do with identity. I didn't realize this, or at least not on the surface. Identity fraud is a big deal when you're applying for an apartment, providing accurate information, and there are people out there, not surprisingly, who are saying that there's somebody else, and so that is something that's being screened for now. Tenant screening reports, they really vary. Our concern with them is we're concerned that tenants know what's in those reports, that just how super important it is to get a copy of your credit report and know what's in your credit report and be able to contact the reporting agencies and get that information fixed. Before you're looking at being turned down for an apartment, you can proactively address that. The same would really apply for criminal background checks. What is in your criminal background? Go to the BCA, find out what's there so that you can be aware what's going to pop up when your application is screened by an agency. You can also, in the same vein, correct those records. I think it's particularly important when we are considering expungements of unlawful detainers and expungements of criminal issues from the past, that those are captured. And in our conversations with prosecutors, we are learning that it's not the best flow of information. You can get an expungement and it may or may not pop up where you need it to when that criminal background check is being run. So finding out right now is the right thing to do.
Ms. Mormon, are there places or social service orgs or the county if you're or even the PHA if you're seeking support with housing, are there places that help people do this? Because just contacting the BCA or just contacting a credit reporting agency is not a simple task if you're not aware that they exist or not able to navigate that system.
I'm I'm not aware specifically of folks out there who help those contacts be made. I know that after the fact, when errors have been found and people have already been turned down for housing, you can ask for a copy of the screening report that shows why you were turned down for the housing. But that's a day late and a dollar short, to say the least. So,
and you would have to know to ask for it.
You would have to know to ask for that report. You are able to get it. You have to know to ask, and you should be getting your application fee back again if you're turned down. So whatever you paid should be coming back into your pocket. Again, if you're running short on funds and you need to make more applications, though, this is really hard. You know, so I'm out $35 here. I'm getting turned down. I won't get the $35 back again for X number of days, weeks, and so on, and I need to turn that around to apply for another apartment someplace else, and that gets kind of tricky. If you're being screened, the federal law, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, does come into play, and so there is a responsibility on the part of screening agencies to provide accurate information, and they are liable. Again, though, I mean, it's a day late and a dollar short if you are being turned down and can't get housing right now. We do need to monitor this for the population as a whole, but as an individual, you know, really hard to make that work to handle your problem you're looking at today. There's one screening agency for sure, and I did provide, this is an ongoing document that we have right now. It's called Tenant Screening Criteria and Costs, and we've listed out at least a dozen tenant screening agencies and what they say they look at and what they say they charge for doing tenant screening. And the very first one up on the list, there are rental history reports, and this could be true of other ones, but rental history reports in particular. They do allow a tenant to apply to get their tenant screening report on their own. So they would find out from this company what exactly their screening report would say, and they would have to pay the fee depending on how much information that they're looking for, and that information would remain live, as it were, for a landlord to be able to log into to look at, to check that information, and they will be coming back to talk about how that might help in decreasing costs. The screening fees, and you can see this in the document, by and large, they range between $25 and $60 is what we're finding. That's just kind of an industry standard. And we're finding that most landlords, the application fees that they charge are pretty much the cost of the screening. They are regulated, and they cannot charge more in an application fee than it actually costs to screen the application. And so, you know, they might have some in-house costs, but they tend to charge out at what the screening report itself costs. So when we think about what we can do to simplify and to decrease costs, we are throwing out some ideas, and with these ideas and ones that we'll be bringing up throughout, we have had some in-depth conversations with the city attorney's office on a number of occasions. And what the council decides are its priorities. They're teed up to go with in sequential order, basically. So the first idea that we're going to put to you as a possibility is to explore whether the city can limit application fees, or if we're preempted under state law from doing so. We're thinking that something like this could fit into the city's consumer protection code. The state of California does have a limit on applications. It's $35. $35 does seem to be a standard that a lot of people look at. That $35 amount, though, is per person being screened. So if you have two adults in a household, you know, that's $70 for the household, and so on. So it's not a small amount of money even still. I think we want to talk about the possibility of yes.
I'm curious, like, how do we just not know the answer to that question?
Excuse me?
Whether or not that if we can do it, that or not. It is explore if the city can limit application fees.
Right now, state law and city code simply say that they cannot exceed the amount of the cost incurred. So applying a $35 limit on it could run counter to what the state law is already providing. And we would feel much more comfortable drafting an ordinance with the city attorney's office, having come up with a legal opinion on whether or not that jives. So we would ask, is that something that the council wants the city attorney's office to do a quick legal opinion on before an ordinance is drafted to put that in front of you? And we'll be kind of saying that consistently throughout.
Okay. So one of the objectives here is to get yes or no on these questions.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And maybe it's a yes, but we can wait 3 months to talk about it, and we need to deal with this one now, and here's where the council would like to go. So okay. That will be kind of a consistent theme.
Okay. Ms. Nanker?
Thank you. I would say yes. I'm sure we'll be discussing all these later.
Yes.
I guess I had thought that that was part of the initial legal analysis, was to kind of be able to winnow down what the city can do and what we can't do. So if it hasn't been done as part of the first study, I think it should be done. And I would also suggest, I know that we are not the only city in Minnesota to be looking at this. Minneapolis has been doing in-depth analysis, mm-hmm. too. And so I just hope we don't reinvent the wheel when it comes to figuring out whether or not a city can take action. We should be working with our partners to learn from what they've already discovered.
Ms. Prince.
And to that point, the Housing Justice Center did a lot of the work that informed what Minneapolis did. So so I think we might be able to get some quick answers there, too. So thank you. Unless you had already reached out to them.
We have had conversations. I guess we're... I think that all of that legal homework that's been done in other locations is going to be fantastic and really a great resource for our city attorney's office. We do need the city attorney's office to sign every ordinance that goes in front of you, and so we need them to feel comfortable with that legal analysis coming forward. So we could tell you what we think, but it's not really our call, you know, and...
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think the second part of what you said was prioritizing, because, of course, if we just dump it all on their desk, a lot of times, actually, that just seems to stop everything from flowing.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can go through this and say, yes, we want to do this, and yes, we want this done today, we want this can wait a week, whatever, would be helpful. But I feel like the things that were in the resolution are things that we want to move forward with unless we can't. So you're going to get a lot of yeses from this group. Okay.
All right, so it seems obvious that looking at standardization of application and screening procedures could lower costs for the industry throughout. And so whether that's something we can regulate or convene a group to have some sort of St. Paul standard arrived at, we'll be revisiting that with a couple of issues in particular around criminal background. But that standardization typically does lead to lower costs. I mentioned how a tenant can get their screening report, and we were curious and would like to have a little bit more information about whether there could be a requirement that if a tenant has secured their own screening report, that a landlord would need to look at that screening report, and the tenant would not have to pay again and again and again. One place where this is happening, not through a private company, but through city government in cooperation with the local housing industry and tenant advocates, is Portland, with Portland One App. And in that case, and that's actually really kind of a cool deal. There's a TEDx talk, if people wanted to look at that, and that the presenter is Tyrone Poole, who was homeless for a couple of years after a major hospitalization, had any number of credit problems, had a UD on his record. He was literally in the hospital for a year, you know, before he became homeless. So lots going on there that would have made his application not look as good. And he was spending a ton of money applying for apartments that he did not qualify for. His thinking was, how can we set this up so that I'm not applying for those apartments, that there's some kind of a filter going on, that I fill out an application, people can see my information, and I will only be referred to apartments that do accept what my application looks like in order to save money. So here's my 5 apartments that work for what I have as background, or so on. I think that something like that could be a time and money saver that would require cooperation among the industry and tenants groups and local government. And it does make sense here to be thinking about that more at a metro level, given that it is a metro real estate market, more or less, not just a St. Paul market. But we wanted to to say Portland's taken leadership on that, and we find the idea kind of intriguing. It doesn't change the criteria landlords are using, but it cleans up the application and the screening, we think. All right. A couple things came up for us, just thoughts on consumer protection issues that were related to this conversation we just thought we would bring up, and that is security deposits and getting security deposits back again and documentation of whether or not the damage that's occurred to apartment is normal wear and tear or if there is something in particular that happened during a tenancy that could be charged reasonably out as damage caused by the tenant. We're thinking that the CFO, the fire CFO, gives a nice status report for where an apartment may have been at a year ago and for some criteria, but it's not nearly as good or in-depth as what an intake form would be. When you do a walkthrough, hopefully, with the landlord and agree upon what the conditions are in the apartment, and so having some consistent measure that is used, and if it's not present, a security deposit would have to be returned. So, you know, you got to be able to document exactly what the damage was and have a sign-off on conditions at the beginning is what we're thinking might simplify things.
So the big change there would be having an intake, basically a check-in list that would have to be compared against.
That is what we're thinking, and that might be a money saver down the line. Again, security deposits and intake forms for when you walk into an apartment to look at it, that is not something that's covered under state law, you know, in terms of like the landlord would need to document it, hopefully, and if the tenant's represented, hopefully there's a good conversation happening about what's going on with that money. But to add an additional layer of assurance would be a good thing, we think.
I guess what I'm hearing is like the simple thing for the city to require is the intake form, because then at least a tenant would have that tool at their disposal.
Yes.
Or an advocate that was working with
Yeah,
them.
And that would need to be done, we're thinking, within, say, 48 hours of move-in or something reasonable. You know, we're concerned. We spoke earlier when we started about rental of condemned units or otherwise unfit units. And the state of California itself, and I don't know if they've passed this, but they were considering legislation that would require payment of relocation costs for landlords who place tenants in unsafe housing. And so we're pretty sure that that would be a state issue, but that is something that the city may advocate or work with the Attorney General's office on to see if there is something possible to increase the level of accountability in those circumstances. I don't know if there's anything worse than standing in front of the city council and having to say that you, for the third time, need to vacate a building that has been illegally rented. You know, and we've had those cases, and they suck. So the last piece that I'll talk about here before I turn it over to Mia has to do with the criminal background checks, and again going to the importance of finding out ahead of time what is in that and being prepared to speak to it proactively and positively, and also to so we get the information, being prepared to speak to it and get corrections into the record if that's what needs to be, if there's an expungement out there, if there's whatever in there, make sure that that's taken care of. We've outlined for you a few different ways that landlords can do lookups. The middle one, the Minnesota Criminal History System, that basically gives the rap sheet on a particular person. You can only get that yourself, but that would give you a really comprehensive look at what your information is that's out there. Our homework was done for us on this subject by and large by a research project done by AON, Beacon, Interfaith, Collaborative, and Common Bond, PPL. They worked with Wilder and released some research in February. And the report's called Success in Housing, How Much Does Criminal Background Matter? And it's really, to the best of our knowledge, the first of its kind piece of research in this area. And it gives us some really great information, I think, as we start a conversation about potential ordinances in this area. 28% of the households that they looked at, 10,500 households, and 28% had at least one adult with a prior criminal conviction. So that is a fairly big number of families that are experiencing this, and in the screening process this will come up. They reported that these tend to be younger, lower-income families, and they're paying lower rents. And talking about now the type of crime and how long ago that the crimes occurred, we've included a table here that they developed, and basically they're talking about the types of criminal background that have an impact on what they call success in housing, which is whether or not people are stably housed over a number of years. And they found that several categories had an impact statistically. Some had a moderate impact statistically, and some had no impact. I'm not sure that I would have cast the bracket quite as far as they did, but that is really super good news that we have a whole category of types of crimes that don't have an impact, and we should be thinking about this as we think about what does a screening agency do with that criminal background when they get it. How do you parse it out and grab the meaningful information and discard the information that isn't going to have an impact on the success of someone in housing? We did take the same set of categories, just as background, though, and run it against the Uniform Crime Report for Minnesota in 2018. And there isn't a direct match in terms of, like, there's 25 categories in the Uniform Crime Report. There's 15 categories reported here. And the crime report just reports arrests. It doesn't report convictions, so it's not tight, but it is saying that like two-thirds of the crimes are that the people are arrested for do end up in the area of having some impact on a person's success in housing. So that is an ongoing concern. The length of time, just really quickly, for misdemeanors, the impact of the crime appears to diminish to insignificant after 2 years. So your success in housing will not be impacted after the event has 2 years passed, and for felonies, 5 years appears to be the magic number. And so, again, that could inform how those screening applications are, that screening material is reviewed, and information can be filtered and discarded. What we're thinking is that there needs to be a community conversation with the major housing agencies that undertook this research, other landlords, tenant interest groups, to look at that research, look at how screening is done, and come up with a plan for how we change screening in St. Paul to take into account what our knowledge and experience is. I'll tell you that I have had some in-depth conversation with some large landlords, and they, two out of the three, do basically screen using the kind of information that Wilder generated with this, which was really good news to me. You know, like, you don't look at misdemeanors unless they were, you know, I can't even remember. The one misdemeanor that got examined and one person that I talked to was, it was driving offenses, and they kept coming home drunk into their apartment building parking lot and running into things. And the playground at this particular apartment complex was immediately adjacent to the parking, you know, area. And so they said, no, you know, you're coming home, you're running into things, we don't want you running into the playground. So that was like the singular instance over the course of 20-some years. A similar look at felonies, depending on the type of felony, I will say. So there is still, I think, a hurdle to be cleared on that. Whether or not the city can, and I know Minneapolis is looking at this, and there's certainly a lot of lawyers with a lot of opinions on this right now, but where we would come out on, could we regulate how applications can be screened in the city according to criminal background, the types of crimes, and the length of time that's passed, that is something that we really do need the city attorney's office to take a look at, to sign off on whether or not that's the right way to go for what we have. Lastly, as we read the Human Rights Code for the city, it struck us that the council, if it's possible, may want to look at whether or not this type of background is something that could be turned into a protected class for purposes of housing. And so that is an idea we had. It, again, like a lot of these measures, though, I'll tell you, applying for an apartment and needing an apartment in 2 weeks and being discriminated against because of your background, but having the ability to impact that decision, like, okay, I'm getting a human rights investigation, something's going to happen, and there's 100 days that they have to do that investigation. It's not a fast response for a critical housing need right now. And so I think we'd like to focus on what can we do right now for somebody who's in a circumstance that they need to be housed.
Thank you. It seems to me from this list, and again, feeling the sense of urgency that I know many of us have to take action on this, that the second bullet point, figuring out if we can essentially require banning the box at the city level, would be the first step. I'm not sure what is meant by the first bullet point. It seems to me this research is really compelling, and that if we found out in our exploration that we could require that this research be adhered to, we should. So can you talk a little bit more about what you meant by working with the major housing agencies to develop standards, especially if absent finding out the second bullet point is possible?
I think that as we as a community approach these issues, and as these agencies who sponsored this research themselves have not, they have in some minor ways changed their screening criteria, but we don't have pilot information on how modified screening criteria would work and develop some level of confidence in the industry, that it would be smoother, I think, and better informed. I would really love it if I could say that this first phase of research that was undertaken by Wilder was definitive and that everybody who participated said, yes, let's do that change right now. They didn't. And so how do we find out what that shortcoming was so that there's a level of confidence in what regulation the city would want to bring forward? So that is a nuanced answer for something that we want to dive in and draw a line on, but it struck us in reviewing the situation.
Am I hearing you say that maybe at the Aon, Beacon Interfaith, Common Bond, PPL, who worked in partnership with Wilder to do this research, could lead by changing their criteria and demonstrate to us?
I think that those agencies have the best knowledge right now out there, and they have a care and concern to even ask the questions. And so we find like a high level of commitment on their part to examine this. Their comments are, yes, we are looking at changing our system and how we do these things, and that's fantastic. And they've even started doing some tinkering here and there and working on it. But they're the ones who have that knowledge and concern, and I think that if we had some set of criteria that, based on the research that they would believe are useful, that would be, I think, something that would garner a higher level of confidence for the property owner community, honestly.
Across the
city.
And probably beyond. Ms. Prince?
And we also have, in St. Paul, Community Stabilization, Home Line, the Alliance, and the Housing Justice Center are working on developing new screening standards. So I think there's a lot of work out there for us to be looking at and bringing those groups into this mm-hmm. conversation. Has Minneapolis is in the process of looking at these particular issues right now. They have not changed any of their ordinances relating to
tenant screening?
There is discussion right now.
Right.
And certainly press releases and public conversation.
Right.
And that going on.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and I know that's the issue where Minnesota Multi-Housing is doing their insidious safe and affordable neighborhoods promotion. So,
and I would just add, I think it's helpful to just dig deep into the research to understand. Here's where the most cynical person would be able to find a weak point and use it to argue. Like, it feels like, I don't know, like opposition research on ourselves isn't quite the right phrase, but like that's the concept I'm trying to evoke. But I also I would push back on, or like, I think we should hold to that. Like, more research won't convince a subset of folks in this industry we're trying to regulate. And so it's important to know the flaws for the footing that we're standing on against the harshest opponents. But there is just, in our society, a stigma, like a cultural stigma of just, like, shame and shunning of people who have, like, committed crimes, whether or not it's, like, a minor crime, a major crime, like, how our law defines. Like, I just think that, like, we should know legally where we're headed. We should know from a research standpoint where we're working with, but we should never forget too that, like, the city can use its power to take a position culturally on, like, what we are trying to do, and I think we feel consensus around the table of wanting to do that. So I want to just, like, add in that we shouldn't, like, not proceed on this just because we feel like the research is going to be unsatisfying to our harshest opponents. So it's just a thought. But, yeah.
We can, I think, piggybacking on that and from what Ms. Mormon said initially, though, is that our public housing authority, our largest landlord with nearly 9,000 units, would not have to comply with this. So there would be also, in addition to exactly what you're saying, there would be value in proving that there isn't an impact to be able to help affect that change on the federal level so that our biggest landlord would also have to comply. So I think it's a both. Ms. Prince.
To that point, Council President Brenmoan, I was in a conversation with Louise Seba and John Gutzman the other day pertaining to the homeless preference that's being added to vouchers. And they are actually considering taking a portion of that program and applying different screening standards. So I think they are in the same place that we are of seeing that we need to bring about some changes.
And they're doing that voluntarily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And they're looking at it. It's not that they've done
right.
it yet.
Right.
Just a point of order, because I want to make sure I'm thinking about my comments the right way. Are we going to go through all of these and then come back at the end to all of these categories and talk about what we want to see move forward, or should we be stake in the ground now for things we want to see on that list?
I think it would be helpful if there's things that are blaring out at you to put a stake in the ground now, if that's okay. I mean, we can always. The problem with, like, making decisions right now as we're on the fly, as we're getting this information, is that it's right now and we're just getting this information. But if there's, I think that there are particular things that we know that we want to move forward with and ask, things that are priorities for us. So if they're there and they're flashing, then I say call it out, especially because I know, I mean, we have a lot of information to get through and not a ton of time to do it. So I would say yes.
Okay, well, with your permission, I mean, I would agree with what you had said earlier about how the things that we put in our resolution are the things that we want to do. And we were asking for research so that we could do those things. So ban the box was something in our ordinance. I would like to see us proceed to find out if we can do that and ideally do it. I couldn't agree more strongly with Councilmember Nelson's point that the cynics aren't going to be convinced no matter how much research. And I also hate just focusing on our staunchest partners in this work as the initial focus of these standards.
Great.
Thank you. I'll be turning it over to Nia.
Okay. So evictions allows the court, it's a court document that gives landlord the ability to recover their tenants. And so I'll be talking about evictions and just cause evictions and right to counsel. We learned that, obviously, earlier Ms. Mormon indicated that St. Paul has the largest percentage of tenants who are persons of color, people who are within 200, within the poverty. And then they also have the highest burden. 30% of their income is dedicated towards their rent payments. And they are also have the highest risk of being homeless. According to the second judicial district, they believe, based on their last 5-6 years of statistics, evictions has trended downward. And we're not sure if it's downward, getting downward because there are a lot of agreements that are done outside of the court system. But the suggestion, based on anecdotal account, is that 25% of settlement fall apart, and also that's also supported by interviews with attorneys in the industry, indicate that 75% of them are successfully succeed in settlement. And then just cost evictions, a landlord can't just arbitrarily ask a tenant to vacate the property. There are three reasons why mainly they would start the process of the eviction, is that one is for non-payment of rent, and this is when a tenant fails to pay their rent when it's due or they've gone past their due rent. In this case, landlords are not, they don't have to provide notice to the tenant when they start this process. It's one of those areas that allows them to do without notice. And I'm going to go back and talk about the requirements later on. And then lease violation is for those who violate certain terms of the agreement. And a landlord must include in their lease agreement a right of reentry for eviction clause. And this has to do with rents, tenants who are disturbing to the other tenants as well, or they cause property damage, or they allow unauthorized persons to live with them, or unauthorized pets that have not been pre-approved. A landlord can also evict a tenant based on any kind on the following illegal activity in Minnesota: unlawful controlled substance in the premises or common area, unlawful use of possession of a firearm, stolen property in the premises or common areas, prostitution, criminal gang activity. The third option that normally leads to evictions proceedings started by the landlord is tenant remains in the apartment or rented unit after getting a notice to vacate as holding over. A holdover tenant is one whose lease has expired, and they've been received property notice to vacate, but they choose to ignore the request, and they remain in the property without the landlord's consent. The process for a landlord to evict starts with a filing fee of $300, and also it would not provide, again, does not provide notice to the landlord that they're going to be evicted. And later on, we'll talk about the fact that there is some momentum among our advocates that having that filing fee in their record hurts their chances of finding housing. And there are some exceptions, though, for tenants who have failed to pay their landlords. The only exception is that landlord must give a 14-day notice to tenant who fails to pay rent and is at will, meaning that there's no lease or rental agreement. This requires a notification piece. I will want to stress out that sometimes there's confusion about these tenancy at will and then those tenancy that has expired. And this is a tenant who say they're consistently pay their rent, they're good, law-abiding, but they have not gotten their rent renewed, and then they get evicted by the landlord for a number of reasons, such as a landlord having to have their sister moved in or brother moved in or for any number of reasons, and they don't have to provide a reason for that, and that's not unlawful under Minnesota State Code. The eviction process, as I indicate here, starts with the filing fee of the evictions. That automatically puts a record on their into their record. They obtain a summons from the court, and they must serve the summons at least 7 days ahead. And then they bear the burden at eviction trial, and they must show that they have proof that the tenant had violated. And then the first option is that if they do prevail at trial, there's a writ of recovery that is that allows the landlord to have a sheriff go out there and take possession of the property. So that was the process for eviction. I'm looking at the Seattle model. And I don't think that they are any different than St. Paul, compared to St. Paul. The difference is that their ordinance prevents a loan for arbitrarily ending a rental agreement where there's a verbal agreement. So when I talked earlier about the fact that that there's no reason that needs to be given provided by the landlord to vacate a tenant who stays beyond their lease agreement, Seattle requires that there's a verbal agreement, and if there is such a verbal agreement, the landlord must follow proper protocol in order to evict. And they state that there are 18 approved reasons. We have a number of similar reasons, and I picked the Seattle model. They have a whole bunch of reasons, and I think we don't have that stated anywhere in our city website or information about that. And if we were to move forward, we may have to identify those areas that we would consider approved reasons. Or just to give you an idea of some of the common reasons that would end a rental agreement, is that if a tenant fails to pay rent after receiving a pay or vacate notice, a failure to comply to vacate the vacant notice, or if an owner wishes to sell the property, they must give 90-day notice prior to the sale. Or an owner wishes to move into the property or have an immediate family member move into the property, they must provide 90-day advance notice. Or an owner who seeks substantially rehabilitate, demolish, remove, or use restrictions, they must complete a tenant relocation assistance. And Marcia indicated earlier that that's what California is moving towards. I'm not sure the last past since, but... And then an owner who wishes to quit the owner's rental permitted accessory dwelling unit with a renter. Right to counsel is something that many cities throughout the U.S. have started moving forward, and they're aggressive in that format. I think we're here exploring. We know that Minneapolis and St. Louis are pursuing that. We don't know where that stands right now in the legally. But I just want to reemphasize again that based on Marcia and my observation at a housing court, we noticed that the percentage of, just based on our observation, that almost 80% of the tenant who goes through housing court doesn't succeed in being returned back to their property, to the rental unit, because they fail to have legal counsel. Housing court is unique, and I think similar to others, that they have SMERLS is involved, the Volunteer Legal Network is involved, dispute resolutions involved in terms of dealing with mediation. They have been successful, but minimal, and they based on their ability to afford whether or not they could afford, based on their income earning. And so, the all advocates believe that right to counsel would level the playing field for tenants who are predatory in terms of harassing their tenants or who wants to remove the tenant for a number of reasons that are unlawful. I believe the Second Judicial District would have, and they are supportive, based on our conversation, supportive of providing some legal assistance, and they already are doing that. Their biggest concern with all these resources from the nonprofit organization is that outside hours are not always available to tenants, and most of the time tenants can't afford an attorney or they can't take time off from their work. And so there's some discussion Marcia and I have been thinking and digging our heads, is that we'll like to provide some support towards all these attorneys are all volunteers, so some support outside of normal business hours that we think would help with landlords who are thinking about evicting their tenants, and that will give the tenants some legal recourse. They don't have the time to research legal help. They don't have time to research for financial assistance if they have to relocate quickly. So we're hoping that in our discussion later on is that we will support some effort in that regards to fund more of our resources to support our existing nonprofit partners. I want to cite here that New York started, 2 years ago, created an Office of Right to Counsel. And they believe that, based on data, that in zip codes that has received legal support, that the eviction rate has gone down. And so I think that there is enough data out there to support this. We believe that we would need to do our own, study here in the Twin Cities to see whether or not that's viable for us. And San Francisco is one of the models that we want to borrow. Unlike New York, they actually create an office that handle that. In San Francisco, they contract that out with volunteer lawyers to coordinate the effort. So they pulled from big corporation, big law firms who have the resources that would provide in case of cases that would, I would say, deemed needing a lot more work involved in terms of challenging. They do a full scope from, sorry, I gotta take this back for a second. A full scope versus a limited scope. A limited scope would be just a consultation, quick legal consultation. A full scope required that eventually they would have to reach trial, and that's when they would have the assistance of an attorney. So what can the steps, what can council do? As I indicated earlier, we can fund efforts to provide counsel to low-income tenants. We believe that nonprofit partners are successful. We can continue to support them and be successful in that regards. We can explore a pilot project, see how that works out, and if that in San Francisco, and they piloted that out and the trend was successful, we can pilot something similar and see if that would work. It would require that we would collect data on our end, and I'm not sure how that would pan out, but that is something that is worth considering. The housing court administrative. And I think this is, I don't want to thank Laura Jelinek from Smurls, who put together this report. And this wouldn't require any cost on the city council's part. And that is to move towards creating, as soon as the eviction filing is entered into the court system, that it remains confidential. That's something that I guess I could ask Laura to talk more, if she wouldn't mind helping.
Maybe sure. Gina could.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, would you mind joining us here?
Sure, thanks.
Give your name first. Good morning. My name is Sheena Thompson. I'm a housing attorney at Smurls. And, yeah, I drafted this proposal to the Committee on Rules of Public Access to Records of the Judicial Branch. This is just a draft. This hasn't been sent in or anything yet. Right now, when evictions are filed in the court, they are immediately public and can be reported on tenant screening reports, and anyone can look them up on the court record on MNCIS and see that someone has an eviction or a UD on their record before there's ever been a court disposition. And these are being used against tenants to deny them housing before a judge or jury has even determined that a tenant has done anything wrong, breached their lease agreement, haven't paid their rent, etc. So the idea is that when an eviction is filed with the court, it will be immediately marked confidential, and it will only be marked unconfidential or released to the public if the tenant loses the case, thus preventing tenants from being denied housing before there's even been a disposition in the case. That is the general idea. Yeah.
And I'm just going to return very quickly back to, I think, the statistic that grounds this, and that is that 75% of those settlements succeed. And so that would mean that that public information about 75% of the filed UDs doesn't become public because it worked. And so this would decrease the amount of unlawful detainers even having the opportunity to pop into the record whether or not they're expunged. So we think that that would be just super helpful. But the city's role specifically, we can be supportive of the pilot in the second judicial district, and you have a role that the council could play in doing that.
All we're asking is that the council give us their support, and we'd like to put the city council's name into this proposal when we list the people who are proposing the proposal and the people who support the proposal.
So formally, like a resolution from the council, or just a letter of support, or
just a yes today.
I mean, I think I've I think there's a yes today, but we could also formalize it under resolution, which may also elevate it in terms of media coverage or just awareness of the project. So I think you can count on our support, and we'll also formalize it.
Thank you.
Ms. Nager.
Thank you. And just to be clear, that's a decision that the county court system would need to make. That's where that authority lies?
I believe in this report that the Governor Task Force on Housing supports this, and the Chief Judge, Judge Guffman, is also in support. And that's a second judicial district.
So it's the rules committee
that would have to...
Of the court.
Of the Supreme Court, yeah.
Okay. So just as another, I think, filter by which we should be looking at these recommendations, I'm really interested in starting with the things that... I definitely want to advocate and support other jurisdictions taking action, but I want to also prioritize the things that we can actually do as a city.
Yeah, and I want to, I guess, take just a minute to pause and clarify something to my colleagues. I've just checked in a little bit with Ms. Nanker and Mr. Tolbert. I think traditionally we would have had a council research do this research and then come meet with us individually about this information. And in the spirit of transparency, you're coming before all of us. We're sharing this with our community. And it, in some ways, I always talk about this struggle between, like, when is too soon and when is too late to engage the community in these conversations. And so I'm struggling because I want recommendations and I want to move forward, and I feel that from my colleagues as well. But I also know that we want to make sure that we're moving forward in partnership with our advocates and community members, and that you're looking for, given what you've done, that information from us. And so I feel like this is sort of an awkward place to be in, because it isn't as definitive as I really want it to be and need it to be, but I also understand kind of what we're trying to do here. So I wanted to just say that out loud as I'm working through that myself, because I think we, and I've heard Ms. Nanker say this and Ms. Prince, and there's an urgency to act because there's an urgency in our housing crisis, and it's getting cold. You know, it feels like summer right now, but the state fair is upon us, and the next thing you know, it'll be winter. So we really want to make sure that these things happen on the fast track once we get through this process. We all just got this information. Yes, you didn't. We got this information yesterday, and we have not had a chance beyond this morning to look at it. So we're going to need that time. So I think it makes sense to continue to go through the recommendations. If something is really, we all know that we want to see this thing go fast, we should bring that to the forefront. But I think after we hear from PED next week with their version of this this report back, that we'll want to go on the fast track in terms of housing. So just really, I'm saying this to let people who are here to see and hear what is being presented to us know where we're at and why this is a bit nebulous. That's the trouble when you grind the sausage in the public eye. So we're gonna pound through the rest of this and then be continuing to move forward with ordinances and resolutions that are local, as well as ways we can partner on initiatives that are happening outside of our area. So a little bit of context. So thanks for the pause.
We can definitely follow up with the council by way of email summarizing what directions we've received today and asking for feedback on how you want things prioritized so we can pull something together to do exactly that. It's really nice right now that I can give you a very simple topic to follow up with, and that is sale notification. There are the idea with the sale notification is that people would benefit, and so the regulatory agencies are going to benefit because they're going to know that a transaction is going to happen and they can keep track of it. Tenants can use the knowledge of an impending sale to make better decisions about their own housing moving forward. And tenants, nonprofits, redevelopment authorities, and so on can use that information to potentially counter offer or in other ways enter into the real estate transaction. We are going to defer entirely to PED and HRA about the idea of right of first refusal for sale of properties. But what we can talk about and what we do think is really doable today in a very simple way is saying that, and we think this is something we could write today, is that the
if you own rental property and you are going to be selling it, you need to provide 30 days notice to your tenant and 30 days notice to the City of St. Paul. The City of St. Paul could also publish this information on the early notification system in a similar fashion as demolitions and condemnations and business licenses and so on are posted on a regular basis. So,
why do we choose closing instead of an advance of like listing?
The real estate market moves pretty darn quickly, and so we wanted to respect that. If we go further out, you know, if I made an offer on a house today and entered into a purchase agreement, it's almost always going to be 30 days waiting period before I would be closing on it. It could be that somebody's transacting it with somebody they already know. It could be that they don't need to list it at all, especially we're hearing that the rental market operates that way. For large buildings, they often transact within a few days. And so we're slowing the clock way down on that if we're saying 30 days, where like single family homes and duplexes are already kind of in the 30-day range. So we went with that, trying to respect the slowness, the speed of the market and slow it down, actually, for the big unit buildings.
Okay. It just seems like if you got notice of closing, it's...
Right.
Sold.
And this is very different than the time that it would take to put together a counteroffer to deal with the right of first refusal and so on. And so we're going to defer there. But for regulatory purposes, we think we could go comfortably with this length of time. And I think you'll hear a different length of time if you have to realistically put together something.
Ms. Brands.
So, Ms. Mormon, are you saying this is something we might have the authority to do without passing an ordinance?
I think that it's very likely that the city attorney would say that you can do this by way of ordinance.
Right.
By ordinance. Yes, definitely by ordinance.
But hasn't Minneapolis passed the 90-day notice of sale? I mean, I thought that was what we were talking about.
Well, I do want to split out the role of the right of first refusal and conflating the kinds of the two things, because I think putting dollars behind that and having PED, HRA kind of coordinating around how that would look from a counteroffer perspective is different than what we can offer, just basic FYI information. So this is the lowest kind of level of notification, and the council may want to do more. We just aren't the people to be addressing that.
Ms. Miles.
So have you looked into the 90-day notice of sale? I mean, is that something that you looked at? Because definitely the information that you have here, these bullet points, would presume a longer notice of sale. So there's the opportunity for potentially a counteroffer or...
Right, and we would split that off and tack that and have the HRA talk about that piece of it, though. We're trying to not talk about the counter offers and the right offers.
Because
I think they are blended more in many. This is separating the two tracks here.
So we're expecting to hear about first right of refusal type of proposal from the PED.
I know that it has been discussed by the Office of Financial Empowerment and it's been showing up in those conversations, and I would say it isn't something that we have the ability to deal with.
Ms. Prince.
But we do, I mean, if we do want to pursue a 90-day notice of sale.
Can I get back to you on that?
Sure, because that's something that I've talked about the housing with the Housing Justice Center, and I think Minneapolis has passed it. So I would... I mean, if we can go there, I think that's our... I think that language was in our resolution. I might be wrong about that. Maybe all we said was notice of sale. But I think the intention was to have a longer period of time for the tenant to find other options, but also in terms of the ability of the larger community to be aware of the sale and... that a property is available for sale and to be able to try to be part of that.
There is...
Ms. Nelson.
Yes, sir. And I would just add to that there's a piece of this, too. separate from the tenant protections work, which is like one angle on this that's like how the city can become a better player in those things too, so that we're using our market power and not just our regulatory power. So just I want to just round out like how the pieces fit together, and the resolution does just say advance notice of sale. It doesn't say a specific 3090, but I would echo the point of what we've heard from folks that we talk with is like it needs to be longer because of how fast the market moves, because of how vulnerable people are. So we can move on from this. I just wanted to add in my thought.
No, I think it's a really important point, and I am interested in this particular piece, but I maybe it's something that gets knit together more once we have information from the PED as well, and we know where we want to move forward with that. I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about single-family homes that people rent, duplexes, big, you know, 12 plexes, and then the big multifamily, and all of them maybe don't fit into the same slot in terms of notification. So I want to know more. I feel like there's a, especially in areas where there's naturally occurring affordable housing, I feel like first right of refusal is a great opportunity for folks. Mr. Basuri.
Thank you. This is a lot of information to digest. I'm new at this, but was any research done on property managers, like home, like for landlords who give up their property to other management companies to manage their rentals, with coming in with new policies compared to the landlords that were there before? Just thinking out loud.
No. That's the fast answer. Okay. We can definitely look at
that. Can we look into that as well?
I think that's going to be a tough nut to crack in that getting at the specific screening criteria and management practices of the different organizations out there that do property management versus individual landlords. That would be, I think, just off the top of my head, a lot of survey work and a lot of relying on people's being forthcoming and taking some time to work with us. But
and the reason why I ask is I've had constituents say, well, there's a new company that came in and took mm-hmm. over, and it's not the same as the landlord before, and they're causing us so many expenses and fixing this and doing this and doing that. So, and again, going to the point of, I saw some resources on here. Do we plan on making more resources available to the community that shows what their rights are, like videos, materials that's printed or posted on our website?
Council Member Bremond, when we looked at this under state law, they do require that public that landlord share the information of public management company with tenants. Mm-hmm. We're not sure where the notification part is, and I can follow up with that. Marcia and I can both do that part in terms of what kind of notice do they provide to their tenant when there's a change in property managing company. I mean, I'm not sure what information we will garner from that, but it'll get us something to understand what kind of policy individual property managers have.
Well, and I think, like, as I've checked in with you as you've been doing your research, one thing that I think has been an overarching theme is education and outreach, that a lot of the protections that we're talking about exist in state or city regulations, but people don't know. Even in what we started out talking about, credit reports, and don't have the ability to navigate those, you know, complex systems. So, I don't. As we're looking at this piece by piece, I'm not sure that theme is coming across. But we, between the work that we're doing, and I believe yesterday, on Tuesday, Ramsey County, hired on. It's a housing. Like a one-stop housing, I don't know the title of the position, but in really moving forward on in the same vein of a one-stop information, something that's housed here at the courthouse where people are coming to housing court have access to it. And so these things are coming together, but with the most important piece being education and outreach. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of protections, but if you don't know about them, they're meaningless.
Council President Brenmo, and that is the last big topic we'll be talking about in just a moment. That is absolutely something that we found is that there's a lot of really good information out there on at least a half a dozen web pages. and with about as many publications or more so. And so how to pull that together so that somebody who isn't familiar with navigating all of these systems can really access what they need quickly and easily. If the council's ready, I would like to just transition and give a fast report on tenant remedy actions. And when we started out, and my experience with tenant remedy actions is sometimes they are just fantastic and they help, and we have cases that are both in front of the council and in front of the court system at the same time. And we've definitely tried to coordinate with SMRLs and Housing Court on these. I'm a fan of how that they have worked in some cases. I'm concerned that it is really heavy machinery to activate.
Is everyone here familiar with the mechanics of a TRA? Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
No. I think that it's really heavy machinery to operate for smaller scale kinds of issues, and it does necessitate going to court on these things. And what I think would be in the interest of the city is to find a tool that's a little bit quicker that we could operate on our own. So I actually did want to touch on why we have so few filings, and you do have a graphic in front of you. 2014, there were 19 filings, and 2017, a few years later, it was down to 5. We had 4 last year. There's very few tenant remedy actions going through court. This is really a different environment than what Minneapolis has. And we've been noodling what could be going on that the Minneapolis housing situation could look so incredibly different than the St. Paul housing situation in terms of tenant remedy actions. The things that are pretty much the same in both areas, that there's an improving economy, obviously, in both, which may mean that there's more money to be putting into basic repairs. The tight rental market, though, is going to likely lead to tenants being less likely to pursue repairs and complaints and so on to be able to maintain tight housing. I think that there's an increase in informal negotiated agreements between tenants and landlords to solve repair and eviction, which is a good thing. I need to plug really strongly here at the city's fire certificate of occupancy program. I can't emphasize almost enough how important that I think it is that there are inspections happening on a periodic basis and they are systematic throughout the property. So, you know, there's many imperfections for sure, but if there's a city inspector showing up every year, every few years, if it's in decent shape and so on, that takes the onus off of a tenant to have to call in those problems. And we've seen in Minneapolis there's much longer stretches of time between inspections and I think different types of inspections, less, I would say, systematic than what we have here for our approach. Lastly, and probably the biggest deal, is that I think here we have a really good network of resource providers for when we find that the water's off, the power's off, the roof is coming in, things like this are happening. And I need to really call out, like, the Waterworks program for getting that water bill paid, energy assistance, the community stabilization project. I have cases come through, and it's like I want to pick up the phone and say, you know, have you looked at this? And they're able to work with the landlords and the tenants, and actions aren't filed. They're picking up the phone, their feet on the street, that are doing just the best job to address things without activating a ton of extra legal machinery, just doing the work. House calls coming in. So, and if I didn't mention SMRLs in there, let me definitely just repeat SMRLs, that those agencies working together change the dynamic, I think, here in town, and I think that people know each other and they're relying on each other when these crises happen.
Ms. Mormon, can you, I think that piece, that sort of wraparound piece that you're talking about, is incredibly important, and I'm glad you lifted that up. I'm wondering if you could explain just a little bit more about how our system is different than Minneapolis, because many of us went to a presentation by the Pulitzer Foundation with the basis being the book Evicted, and really listened to a lot of statistics and advocates talking about the state and condition of housing, but it was Minneapolis, and all the statistics were Minneapolis, and the TRAs were Minneapolis, and it was very different from ours. And you know, even reading the book, Evicted, I wondered what the difference was between St. Paul and Milwaukee in terms of calling in problems and how those how these things were different. And our certificate of occupancy program, as you mentioned, it is different, and it grades properties on a basically a letter grade, A to D. And if your property is an A property, you'll get less frequent inspections. If you're a D, you get inspected every year. So there are, when you say periodic, it is really based on the condition, underlying condition of the property, and that grade can change from one inspection to the next. So a tenant wouldn't necessarily have to call to get an inspection. They're going to happen, especially in properties that are in worse condition. What is the process in Minneapolis, or what is the other big differences?
I was not at that POLED presentation, so I'm not ready to speak to what was presented there and comparing it to St. Paul. I can definitely go back and pull that, and I've read Evicted as well. And Milwaukee is in a really difficult situation, too, I think, with changes in Wisconsin state law and how they're able to approach owners. So we could definitely do a comparison of what the inspection processes look like across those three cities.
But predominantly, you were mentioning that our C of O program is different and in some ways helps protect tenants because of the system.
I believe that's true.
I'm not sure everyone knows that we have that process. So.
Yeah. So time and money. We need a system to work quickly so that people can continue to be housed. Sometimes I think that going to court does slow things down. And when we have dire conditions to be addressed, time is money. And it's also a roof. We have, as the city of St. Paul, when circumstances have arisen where a nuisance condition exists inside a house and affects neighboring properties, we've been able to activate nuisance abatement tools. So we can say that the infestation problem at this particular property affects the adjacent property, which is a public nuisance. We will go in and first order that this be addressed by the owner, but step in pretty quickly on our own to make sure that that is addressed so that the impact on the neighbors is diminished. We have talked to the city attorney's office and would like to explore a tool whereby the city could similarly issue an emergency repair order, which would be a short order for a landlord to take action, and that the city would step in and take action and use that same assessment tool we use on nuisance abatements, but that the city itself could be acting on a short order for emergency repairs. And that, we think, would be pretty fast and pretty elegant in its operation. I think that the city could also work with the court system to expedite hearings and so on. I have to tell you where I'm coming from on the time question has to do with one that was in front of you, I want to say a year ago, maybe 2 years ago now, 2 years, and that is the case at 1032 Duluth Street, and I did put a little case study in there, but I got to tell you, there's a fire in the utility room. It took out the electrical and mechanical systems for the building. The Red Cross puts up people for 3 days. Then the people are left hanging. The city says, hey, landlord says, I'm going to get this thing done really quickly. City says, oh, we hate to do this, but we're going to let the people back into the building again. We got 2 out of 4 boilers up. This is now late November, and it's getting really cold. We have emergency electric up, which means the hallways are electrified, but not the individual apartment units. We've got people moving back in. They're cold. They don't have refrigeration. They don't have electric to run oxygen if they need that. And there's extension cords running everywhere. It just got worse and worse and worse. And although a tenant remedy action was filed at the same time, basically, as the fire 3 days after, the court hearing wasn't until December 7th to follow up on whether or not the landlord had taken action to address these things. The council had to make a decision to vacate that building on appeal, and that sucks. Ramsey County was able to step up. with five, actually I think they extended it to 6 days, help in a hotel for people who didn't have other places to go. And then the St. Paul Foundation stepped up and added a couple days to that to make sure that we got people carried over to when the building could be reopened on December 6th, the day before the court hearing. So I guess what I'd like to say is I don't want to see that kind of circumstance come forward again if there's things that we can do to prevent it and if the city has the ability to issue that kind of an emergency order and then assess the cost of the taxes, we could speed up making sure that that building is safe and ready to house people.
And in the spirit of the priorities and red lights, that's one that I think is really important to move forward with. We already know how to do abatement orders efficiently. Yeah. We have time and time again, people come before the council in homes that are not fit for habitation because of some level of condemnation, and we know that they're going to be on the streets. And if the city could go in and take care of the problem and bill it back to the landlord in a way that's legal and efficient and quick, then the person stays housed, the problem gets fixed. And I think at the end of the day, we all win. It's probably more expensive for the landlord, but there is a way for them to avoid that, mm-hmm. get the problem fixed. I saw Ms. Nelson had her hand up.
I think it's been covered, but like to put this idea in action to the points you just made, and if we had had this system in place at the time of this case study, instead of waiting and losing critical time and people being like triple punished for being out and destabilized, we would issue an emergency order as a city as soon as the fire happened. We would go in and determine the scale of repairs. We would tap into an emergency city repair fund, which would have helped the necessary work happen. And then we would have been able to work with our partners to provide supportive housing in between. Is that how you imagine a rapid response system like this working, and then we're not even dealing with the court, we're going outside of it?
There's no question that the landlord needs to be given an opportunity to undertake the work. In this particular case, the landlord was not pulling the trigger on doing the repairs, but started shopping for different bids, and insurance companies come into play as well. You know, so if an insurance company doesn't want to pay out for a particular bid and is holding, that holds everything up. A city order just, skips past that. And we know that in cases where there's an emergencies like a boarding needs to happen after a fire or a break-in and so on, these are things that insurance policies do cover just as a part of their normal items. And so we're thinking that by and large that this would work better and short circuit some of those delays for major problems.
Ideally, forcing the landlord to take action more quickly, but in the cases where they don't, we have the fund and resources and ability to take care of the problem.
Yes.
And in all cases, that tenant would be less likely to be displaced.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think we're just going to talk about education and resources.
Yep. So we're towards the end, council members. This list, by far, is not a complete list of resources that are available to tenants in Minnesota. When Marcia and I started taking on this task, we were wondering where our single site that would provide all the resources with regards to tenant education about their rights and what they can do. And we discovered that there are many sites, cities out there that does a really good job of compiling all the information into one central location. And we want to model something similar. We took a look at a couple cities, and we really liked the way San Jose put together their information. And I just want to share with you how they do it. They provide information here quickly. They do a quick video about renters and landlords' rights. They talk about the apartment rent ordinance. They provide the actual language. We don't have an Ellis Act ordinance. I won't talk about that, but they put all the fact sheets about the ordinance on one site, and they look at rent registry. So this is all one site for tenants to see and locate, and we don't have that here in the city of St. Paul, and we're hoping that this is something that we move forward in centralizing this information that we put in one site, and we provide something that's easily accessible to any renters, any residents in the city of St. Paul. And so we kind of like the layout there. This list, is, like I said earlier, by far is not a complete list, and it just gives you a rundown of financial assistance resources, legal assistance resources, other housing resources. And ability, we talk about ability to getting your screening report. I didn't include criminal report in here. And there's a links to our housing codes and inspections, and we don't have a Bill of Rights here, so I'm not including that here. But this is not a complete list, but it gives something to start off with to say they can be centrally located. I don't have anything else to add on this other than this, when we met with the court, the second judicial court administrator, they also are in support of providing more education on the streets. They want to put some kind of fold in there, and I think Council President Bramble, when you indicated earlier that Ramsey County is moving toward a one-stop site, I think that plays a role in educating our residents here too, and I think we should, I support that as well, and the work that we were doing, that we hear that really loud and clear.
And I would point out again, just as what you mentioned in the beginning, I mean, St. Paul is 56% of the population of Ramsey County, 3/4 of the rental population of Ramsey County. If they're putting the resources behind this work, there's no reason why we shouldn't have whatever they've come up with even just put a different skin on it, put it on our page. But there's ways that we don't have to duplicate effort here.
Right.
That can help facilitate this. So we should be in tight partnership with the work of Ramsey County as well. Ms. Nelson.
Another thing this makes me think about in the tenant resources and education category is just one of the learnings that really emerged from all the housing convenings that we did around the city, where folks said people just don't even know what's available to them. They don't know if their rights are being violated. They don't know if you are getting that screening happen, and then they don't return your feedback and turn you down, and they don't give you a copy. Like, people, there's a lack of understanding of, like, what is my recourse? It's, like, too little, too late, and also you were, like, additionally harmed against the law. And so I've been really thinking about, like, how in buildings where multiple things are happening to multiple people, individuals in those units are, like, going through it by themselves, but then one by one, when tenants understand it's not just them, they can organize and they can force action and they can run direct actions on their landlord. And so I do think, in addition to empowering people with information and doing more things like this to put the law in front of folks and understand it's their law, like, we have to figure out how to support tenant organizing in our community, like site-based tenant organizing in our community, and how the city can help empower folks and put our money or support behind that or both. So I'm just thinking about that a lot as like an ingredient that I think exists but is underestimated. And I think this is a lot of good research to dig into, and we'll keep exploring it. But it connects with engagement that we've done leading up to this too.
And I think there's an opportunity here. I mean, I want to keep my eyes on our timing as well, but we, again, are getting reports back from different parts of the city, the mayor's office, our PED, this council research. I think that there's, following those presentations, we would like to debrief with advocates and community members about what they've heard and what their priorities are, as well as what my colleagues' priorities are. And so we do, again, we're kind of grinding the sausage as we go along here, but I think the next step after we get all this information will be to check in with organizations as well and get some feedback on what we should be prioritizing and which of these potential paths forward make the most sense. Are there thoughts before we? All right.
Okay.
Oh, Ms. Prince.
Just one other thought. I really like this approach to having a site where information is available, tenant rights and landlords. Obviously, there's the language thing, so we've got to work that into it. But also, and I don't remember if anyone talked about this, for the public, for tenants and people making applications to rental buildings, to be able to access the C of O rating, if it's an A, a B, a C, or a D property. And that's public information, I'm assuming.
And I think that could be a lot more visible on the city's website. I think that we could do better in that. I don't know. I know there's a lot of projects that DSI has for OTC to be working on, but I think that would be a great piece of information for people looking at properties.
Yeah, and potentially having a link on a page like this to that information.
Yeah, that it should be. We keep track of it. It's important information. It should be very easy to find. It's not something that just DSI should be aware of.
Yeah.
As a renter, if I'm going into a D, minus apartment, those ones that just bump right along the bottom, I think that it empowers me as a tenant to know that. So, as a council, we can make that a priority with OTC as well. Okay.
And we're on to the last one, and I just let me switch here.
I know. Sorry. I'm just giving it like showing that me.
This is just unlike other city where they have very specific ordinance about it. In City of St. Paul, we have. Our chapter, the building and housing chapter, talks a lot about how we can keep the house in a safe and decent and habitable state. And we have chapter 34, chapter 40, chapter 53 are the three that we rely on to ensure that the housing is in a safe, in a safe state. Chapter 54, we talk about the application tenant screening. And Marcia and I believe that we can beef that up a little bit more. There's room for that. The anti-discrimination law under the Human Rights Chapter 183 is another area that we are looking to also add more language that would support the council's initiative. Under state law, there's one chapter, Chapter 504B. It talks about all tenant rights and landlord rights. It's just a whole list here. I don't know of any other ordinance out there. I'm looking in the City of St. Paul. This is all we have. There's our limitations in here. And as Marcia and I indicated earlier, I think we talked a little bit about the security deposits. Marcia started about that list that we talked about, the CFO report. That's something that we would like to add under the consumer report, and we believe that we may need an enabling language to have that take place or not. But we're exploring that with the city attorney's office.
A lot of what we're talking about we think would be really ideally housed in a consumer protection type section of the code, not unlike truth and sale of housing reports are in that section of the code. There's clear monitoring by the Department of Safety and Inspections so that we could have similar kind of a parallel setup for rental housing and the different requirements that the council goes with.
And I know, there everything is written. Well, I guess I would just say that we also piggybacking off organizations and entities that already have good information out there. The Attorney General's Office produces the Landlord and Tenants Rights and Responsibilities Handbook, which is it's not a tenant handbook or a landlord-tenant, but somewhere in between. And it is produced in many different languages, and you can get many copies of it free of charge. And so that doesn't cost anything for us to share or to let people know about. It's also available online. But the fact that it's in many languages, and if we collectively believe that there's a language that they need to produce it in, our Karen community is growing by leaps and bounds. Do we have a Karen edition of that? I don't think we do, but maybe as a city we can say, hey, this is missing from your selection. So making sure that we're, again, using the resources that are out there and not taking 6 months to do what's already been done is important as well.
That's it.
Great. Well, and we've sort of talked this through as we've been along the way. Just really appreciate the level of this is a very wide-ranging research project that you went into, and I think we're really eager to get to the what are the recommendations and how do we move forward portion of this. So it's good background, and we will look forward to hearing from PED next week as we close up this series of report backs. Ms. Prince.
Yeah, and I want to thank you for all this work. With the volume of legislative hearings you guys are running, sitting in a significant report of this type is really appreciated. And I also want to thank all the advocates who are here because we really appreciate that a lot of this has come to us from you already and we're trying to catch up. And we want to continue to hear from you and what your priority would be and where we start and how we just get going on this. To Council President Brenmoan's point, we're coming up on winter and we wanted to get this stuff done in 2019 or at least get a good jump on it. So thank you for your patience, but keep the heat on.
Great, pun intended.
Anything else before we close up here today? All right, so part three next week. Thank you again for being here, for your presentation, for your hard work, and thanks for advocates for joining us. We appreciate your work as well. We are adjourned.